Gerard, welcome to Business Uncomplicated. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Rich, lovely to be here.
How are you? We have a lot to cover today, and it's a really interesting topic. We've had a couple of people on the podcast talking about talent and what talent looks like, not only now, but in the future. And a lot of that has to do with shifting markets, but we want to talk about AI as well, because that plays into every conversation anybody has today. So you kind of can't get away from that discussion. But first, I want to talk a little bit about your background. You've had an interesting journey in your career. It didn't seem very linear to where you are today. So would love to get a little bit about, you know, how you find yourself in the position you find yourself in today, and what kind of brought you to it.
Yeah, sure. I don't know anyone that follows a very linear career.
Very fair point.
In life. And you think when you're finishing school, you've got all this pressure to decide what you want to do with your career, which is the stupidest question ever, because no one ends up staying in that path anyway. So it should be, what do you want to do next year is the proper question.
That's exactly right.
And for me, though, it was, I didn't know what I wanted to do finishing school. And so I did commerce, went to the University of Melbourne because it was the broadest degree you could do. And then when I was in commerce, I had to major either in marketing, accounting, actuarial studies, and management. And I thought, well, who studies to be a manager when they're 18? Actuarial studies, I don't think I'm smart enough. Marketing wasn't that popular back then. So accounting was the one left over. So I majored in accounting. And then before I finished my degree, I got a job at a firm called Pitcher Partners, and I went into their audit division and I started being an auditor. So it was completely by mistake that I fell into that. And then I ended up staying there for 10 years. So I had a 2 week break in the, sorry, a 2 year break in the middle of it. And I moved to London. I had a great 2 years living in the UK, and I worked in investment banking at the Royal Bank of Scotland for a little bit during the GFC. So I was working there as Lehman Brothers collapsed and the RBS got bailed out by the UK government twice. So it was interesting working in the Treasury Department through that. So a good experience, but a bit scary because everyone around me was losing their jobs. And then when I came back to Australia, I helped set up an outsourced CFO division at Pitcher Partners, and that opened up a whole lot of new clients for me to go a bit deeper into different industries. And one of those industries was international education. And I got to learn about the experience for international students that were in Australia. And to be honest, I hated the way we treated international students. The universities treated as a cash cow, pay four times more than what a local student pays. So, you know, Rich and Andy, you both walk into a car dealership and Rich, you pay $30,000 for a car and Andy pays $80,000 for the same car. And you think, how does that make sense? Just because you've got a different type of visa.
Right.
But that's how the international education system works. And to be fair, the people paying more actually get a worse service. They're sort of treated like second-class citizens almost. So I had a fight with the vice chancellor one day about what the purpose of a university was. And his argument was it was to teach people how to think and to give them a certificate. And I argued it was to get them a job. So if you're going to spend $100,000 to move to another country and to get a degree in IT, you probably want a job in IT. And that wasn't really the way it was, still not now. So I quit my job and started a business. And my first brand was called Outcome.life, which was based on if you could choose your outcome from your education, you could have a better life. Because that is what an international student is trying to do. And that's what their family is, put all their money, you know, they're effectively investing all their money into sometimes only one of their kids to get a better education. Because the best way out of poverty is through education. And I focused on helping international students to get their first experience. And to do that, I realized that internships was the best way for that to happen. Once you had done an internship, you're at least in the experience bucket instead of the no experience bucket. The worst place to be is the no experience bucket. No one wants to hire people with no experience, even though they're hiring. It's funny when you see job ads, we're hiring a graduate, you have to have 3 years experience. And so you see that situation. And so we started doing internship placements, and then decided that I wanted to do it with a technology solution. So we hired a whole lot of engineers and built a technology platform, and that was called InternMatch. And the universities became our clients, and we started took that all over Australia, into the UK and into Canada.
And was the goal of that to just get people into internships, to get them the experience? Like, what was the actual goal of that?
Yeah, so the goal was to exactly that, to help them get a job at the end of an internship. Was my ultimate goal. Now, the universities ended up being the ones that would pay us to to provide that service because they realized they're really bad at doing that, that all of them had to try it first, fail at it, and then they would call us. But yeah, but to make it a meaningful experience that they could then leverage that to get employment at the end of their degree.
And I would assume the universities, it gives them a marketing, right? Hey, we get internships, you get a job at the end of this. Because
right, our placement rate, right?
Right. To your point, most of us who went and got our degree, it, like at the end of the degree, it was, okay, now what am I going to do? It wasn't, oh, now I'm this great philosopher and I'm going to go write a book or, you know, be Jack Kerouac and travel around. We wanted to parlay that into something.
Yeah, exactly. And so around the time, and this is in 2017, I started it, there was a big focus on graduate outcomes that universities were starting to get measured and financed based on graduate outcomes. So there's a bit of a tailwind for us that the unis had to focus on this now. And then they needed solutions to help make sure that, you know, because it's a very big difference between doing a degree and actually having real world experience, you know, sitting in, back then we used to go to the office, by the way, people went to an office every day. So you're sitting in an office every day, you're learning a lot more than you are sitting in a lecture hall.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Just through the osmosis.
Yeah, COVID has really, there are some, it's interesting, somebody was saying the other day, there are people who, you know, started their career maybe the year before COVID or COVID and never have understood what it was like to have an office job. Because even most of this back to office politics that are going on, it's still not 5 days a week. And most of them wouldn't remember when you had to wear a shirt and tie if you were in finance. I started in banking and casual Friday was, you can take your tie off if you want to come in casual on Fridays. And you're like, thought it was the greatest thing in the world. You didn't have to tie a tie on Friday, you know?
Yeah, the same. I started my career when we were full suits, including a tie, and it slowly dropped to tie off Friday, same as you. And then it was eventually no tie. And then I go back into that same firm now and there's people walking around in shorts and t-shirts. I'm like, what are you guys doing? Like, they have this thing called dress for the day, whatever the hell that means. But yeah, young people, I say young people, but they don't realize that if you wanted to work from home one day, you ask permission a week in advance that you need to work from home for one day. Now it's like you ask permission to go to the office.
Right.
It's true for all the benefits that it does give you when you are there, which is interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I met my business partner because I was sitting, and this is what, again, I feel sorry for people that are entering the workforce now because they don't get the benefit of this and they don't know what they're missing out on. But I was just sitting at my desk and one of the partners was on his way to a lunch and the client had just pulled out. So as he walked out of his office, he virtually walked into my chair and he's like, Jared, what are you doing now? I'm like, oh, you know, working. He's like, well, the client has pulled out his lunch. Do you want to come? And I'm like, Yeah, of course I want to do it. Now, I was the youngest person there by 10 years. Like, I didn't have a right to be there, but it was right place, right time, sitting in the office. And the guy I sat next to ended up becoming my business partner 4 years later. But you don't, like, no one's sitting, you're not sitting here now and thinking, oh, I'll just jump on a Zoom call with Simone and see if she wants to come to this event. Like, out of sight, out of mind. And that's what, all that stuff just doesn't happen as much anymore.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, now you have to text and say, hey, can I call you? It's crazy. So then that led you to Talent Match. So tell us about Talent Match, what you guys offer now and what that journey's looked like.
Yeah. So, and going back to the very, very first comment around your career is not linear and you don't know where it's going to go. I never, ever in my like fantasies thought I'd have a business in Africa, but you create your own luck by getting out there and doing things and things, opportunities present themselves. And I think the more entrepreneurial you become, and I've switched from being an accountant, which is the most un-entrepreneurial job on the planet, maybe lawyers, to then being an entrepreneur where like your brain has to change the way it thinks. And it literally takes a couple of years for that to happen. But then when that, you start to flex that muscle a lot more, you see opportunities differently and you take advantage of opportunities. So I met Nelson Mandela's grandson in January 2020, a gentleman called Zondo Mandela. He lives in Cape Town, is the youngest grandson of Nelson and Winnie. And he asked me, his question was, why are you helping privileged people? And I was a bit taken back by that question. I'm like, mate, international students are not privileged. Like, I can tell you many a story. He's like, no. What I meant was, what we need you in Africa. We need a model like yours in Africa. We have really large youth unemployment problems. Young females unemployment is above 60%. So if you are born a female right now, you're more likely to never have a job than have a job. Like, we need a model like yours in Africa. Look, okay, now I understand where you're going, but I've never been to Africa. I got no idea. Like, you know, at the minute I was building a business in Canada, in the UK. That's where you take a business to. Start in Australia and you try to go to the US.
Absolutely.
And yet that one question sort of triggered something in me, and the pandemic happened 5 weeks later. And all of a sudden we're stuck in our living rooms. Yeah, we were in Melbourne, was the most locked down city in the world for a very long time. I think Shanghai eventually just pipped us at the end. But, you know, for a while we were allowed out of our homes for 1 hour a day. Like, it's actually weird to think about. But did that really happen?
Seriously. Yeah, and can we never have that happen again ever in our lifetimes or our kids' lifetimes? Like, honestly, yes.
I just could go back to Texas because we could do anything we wanted in Texas.
I mean, yeah, we were jealous of like other places around the world. You know, have friends that would send you videos about doing stuff, and it's still a sore point in Melbourne. We don't talk about it very much. Everyone's got PTSD. But I started realizing that remote work was becoming a thing. And again, what we were talking about before, like in 2019, like boards and CEOs and executives, they didn't just let people work from home as much as, you know, whenever they wanted to. Like, boards didn't trust people working at home. Like, there was a whole, and I don't know if you remember, like the early stages of COVID, when people were working at home, and there's all these articles in all the business media outlets saying, can we trust people to work at home? Like, how are we going to know they're working? Right. And then but productivity started going up during COVID. Like, people were getting stuff done and businesses were getting stuff done. And everyone's like, whoa, okay, maybe we can trust our staff. So you had this shift towards, like, if I'm living in Melbourne, I've got someone working for me that's 3 kilometers down the road and I'm not going to see them for the next 6 months. Well, why do they have to be in Melbourne? Why can't they be in Johannesburg or Nairobi or, you know, Cape Town? And the answer was, well, they could be, as long as they've got fast internet, they've got a computer, they've got someone to work from. Doesn't matter where they are. So this was sort of happening around that time. And I'm like, okay, maybe there's something in Africa for us. So we started running some pilots in South Africa, flexing the model a little bit, making lots of mistakes. And then as soon as the borders opened up, I jumped on a plane into Ethiopia, Rwanda, Kenya, and South Africa. And that trip just completely opened up my horizons. I'm embarrassed to admit what I thought about Africa before that trip, because I'd never been to Africa and my vision was World Vision ads. And, you know, you can imagine what's on a World Vision ad. That is just how I thought Africa was going to be when I got off a plane. And then I got there and I was like, whoa, this place is amazing. Look at all the infrastructure and the people that I met, the level of English, like tech savviness, educated. Just, I'm like, this is the world's best kept secret. Like, why does everyone go to the Philippines and India for resourcing when you've got this talent pool of, you know, it's going to be 2 billion people? So Talent Match Africa was born off of that.
Was that a result of Africa's investment in universities? Because I've never really heard a lot about Africa. We've talked about, you know, the book I read, and we shared that last time we talked. But what was the explosion in Africa around this talent? That was it an investment from the African government? Was it just the need of the people who pursued it? Like, where does the zest or the education level come from?
I think it's always been there building. It's just that you just don't think that. Like, the University of Cape Town is the 26th ranked university in the world. Like, amazing university. And you've got a huge population that, you know, people are going to school despite what, you know, I might have thought, and people are going to university, and population of over 1 billion people. Like, just by pure maths, like, if you take the top 1%, there's a huge number of people that are really, really smart. And so, yes, there's the poverty part of Africa, which is large too, but I was like, if we just go and get the top 1% of people on this continent, like, we can, like, millions of people. So I think that's more of the realization for me, Rich, is like, there's so much positive here, yet you just don't think that.
Yeah. Give us a little bit of context here, because I think a lot of us have that, like, okay, that same notion that you had of, you know, I've heard that, you know, Africa is exploding, the population is exploding, the young people are exploding. I know that the education's gotten better, but what does it really look like? So for the people who maybe have that, I've never thought of Africa as a talent pool. Give us the ad. What does the talent pool look like?
So I'll break it up into two components. One's about the people skills, if we call it that, and then there's the technical side of things. I think one thing that has just surprised a lot of our clients, or our clients have found hugely enjoyable, is just these outgoing person, the natural outgoing personalities of Africans. Like, they're just out there, they're buoyant, they're just naturally like that. So you're dealing with people that are happy, that are, you know, bringing energy to a room, whereas there's some other outsourcing countries where his reputation's probably not like that. It's very much subservient and will do something when we're told to do something. And we had an example as a client out of New York, and they were an agency, a digital agency, and you know, they had 5-6 people in the Philippines, and they ended up taking on 3 people of ours in Kenya. And within 5 weeks, they got rid of the Filipino team. Now, not great. That's not, you know, I'm not trying to, I don't want people to lose their jobs in any part of the world. But I called up Garrett and I said, mate, what's going on? Like, why have you done this shift? And he's like, okay, Jared, I'll be blunt with you, but my Filipino team did A, B, C, D, E. He said, within 2 weeks, the Kenyan team said, Garrett, if you just do G and F, you don't even need to do A, B, C, D, E. Like, just, let's just change the way we do things. So they were challenging, you know, their processes and bringing them ideas. And I think that the level of English is probably the other one. Andy, like, just really strong English in the countries that we're in. So, you know, we're largest in South Africa and Kenya. Like, English is pretty much a first language when kids are growing up. And then accents are pretty neutral too, particularly in South Africa. So sport is another one that's very popular. So you've got this affiliation. So I think just on the natural, just people side of life is just so well aligned. And then on the technical side of things, a lot of the average age is 19 in Africa. So if you look at Europe, you know, it's in the 40s and, you know, Monaco is like 60 or something. But it's an extremely young population. So you've got this really young group of people that are coming through, that they're living in a world of tech, and, you know, and there is, you know, Android phones are not that expensive. So, you know, everyone does have smartphones, and you know, people are, or young people at least, that, you know, you're surrounded by technology all the time. So you're connected to the internet. So people are going, doing their own learning and development on top of their education. So tech savvy is just like part of the DNA as well. In Kenya, there's a technology called M-Pesa, which is like a complete fintech product effectively, but just runs there. And it's like WeWork. It's like WeChat, sorry, for China. But M-Pesa's out of Kenya. I think it's even before WeChat. And it's an incredible technology. Like, you say, whoa, where'd this come from? So I think there's just all these layers of the human element and also technical capability coming out of universities. And, you know, there's millions of people coming out of universities every year. And so as we present people to our clients, and initially we went down very heavily on doing videos because, you know, if I'm speaking to a client that's never been to Africa, I just know in the back of their mind, they're like, what's this sort of going to be like? And then we'd send them a video and they're like, whoa, you're like, that's the type of people we can get? I'm like, yes, there's millions of people like this. And then once, you know, people said one person, then it just builds on top of it.
So you said the average age is 19. For your profile, a lot of the world deals with antiquated technology. I'm working with a client who has a 30-year-old mainframe. We're dealing with Salesforce, Oracle. I mean, and even by standards of today, Salesforce is a young company, right? It's only like sub 30 years old.
I think you just called Salesforce antiquated. I love that.
AI may do that for them.
Anyway.
Yeah, it's giving it a run for the money, right? Are the people you're employing, or the CVs you get, are they versed in these technologies? And is it something that they study for these technologies, even though I would guess, you know, we're still in the early stages of AI, or are they really kind of trying to be AI native, as we like to say now?
Skip the middle-aged technology.
Right. Yeah, middle-aged technologies, right?
I think it's going through the same journey that we're going through in the USA and Australia and these other wealthier markets, where everything you really learn that's valuable, you learn on the job. So it sort of might be anyway. Like, you know, universities don't teach Salesforce or HubSpot.
No, yeah.
Right. But, you know, teach your fundamentals. So the same rules apply, that, you know, Salesforce is really big in South Africa because all the banks are on Salesforce, and all the big, there's some big, big corporates in South Africa, and a lot of them are on Salesforce and Oracle and, you know, the systems that you would expect. And now there's a push with obviously AI and what does that mean? And, you know, can you build your own CRM using Claude as an example? So maybe you don't need to have a HubSpot or a Salesforce. And I think that creates such a big opportunity for the developing world, and you know, I'll think more about Africa, that, yeah, to your point, Rich, can you jump some of these learning curves that you have to go through? Because you jump to using some of these tools, and then all of a sudden you're able to do so much more, and you're able to bring a skill set to a business that the business doesn't even have yet, because you know everyone's not necessarily up to date with some of these AI tools. So I think that shift is happening. And I think having, you know, a 25-year-old or even a 30-year-old that's been a marketing manager for 8 years that has just fallen in love with Claude is now able to just to do an enormous amount of things. And I think that just creates such a big opportunity to be able to, I think, even the playing field for the wealthy countries and the not as wealthy countries, that if you can make sure people have the hardware, they've got access to the AI tools, they can compete at a level that maybe that we haven't been able to before. And obviously the wages are a lot lower in these other countries. Cost of living is a lot lower. So, you know, I was in San Francisco this year and a coffee cost me $13. One coffee, $13. Didn't even have milk in it. And I'm like, how do people live in this city? Like, I understand why people need to get paid so much. Like, coffee is $20. So there is the arbitrage on wages around that.
When you're working with new customers, what is the biggest, what's the biggest pushback or the biggest miss that you see when you suggest, hey, outsource to Africa?
The biggest pushback is the frustrating pushback, which is the pushback you never hear. So, you know, I try to put myself in the headspace of me 6 years ago before I'd been to Africa and what was in my head about it. You know, and I mentioned before that what World Vision had played such a big part of that. Like, I've spent probably 7-8 weeks in Rwanda. It's one of my favorite countries in the world right now. Now, I'll admit it, before I went to Rwanda the first time, all I thought about was the genocide. That is all I thought about going there. And I just couldn't believe how far that country has come along in 30 years in what it is today. It's a beautiful place, a beautiful people, and it's just incredible. But, you know, I had this other vision in my head. And so I think there's a lot of those subconscious biases, Andy, that are always come into play. You know, I've had people say, but they have the internet. Like, can people speak English? So it's all these things. And then it's like, can they do the job at the level we need them to? So, I mean, look, South Africa's had a recent history of having, you know, power going off. So people have consistent power. Now that's got a lot better now. And we've got office facilities that has backup generators and, you know, you work your way through all of that. And then it's once someone actually starts working with someone, it's just amazing. We had another case yesterday of a guy called Sam working with a company. They originally wanted him just on a 3-month project. They weren't too sure about it. We'll just commit for 3 months. And within 6 weeks, they're like, we're extending this for forever. This person's amazing. Like, so awesome. It's once you actually start working with someone from the continent, a business does, and they have that first experience, it's like, oh my God, my horizon's been completely opened up here. But I'll admit, I think a lot of clients are doing it the first time. They're nervous. Like, they just don't think the quality is going to be there, and they're pleasantly surprised when it is.
When you have new clients, what's your typical renewal rate, or you know, dry out the engagement rate?
Dry out? What do you mean by that?
Draw it out. So in terms of adding on, like, okay, we'll do the test, but how long do your average client stay with you?
Sure. So our position is that they've got a staff member forever. Now, obviously, that's not realistic. No, it's never going to be, but it's like that mindset. So the team member coming is like, hopefully this is a great relationship. You're going to be working in a good culture with good people. You know, Rich is your manager. He's a great guy. You're going to like, it's going to be a great place to work. And because the businesses obviously have to create a good environment as well. And then from the business side of things, saying like, why do you want to train someone for 6 months, 18 months, 2 years, and they leave? Like, everyone gets frustrated by that. Like, once you've got a good team member, you want them to stay. So that's like the overall mindset. And then sometimes it's not, you know, we've had, I think there's a lot happening at the minute with budget issues with a lot of businesses. The economy is not doing very well. You know, that's not going to get talked about in the New York Times, or Trump's never going to mention it, but there's a lot of businesses that are struggling. And so, yeah, sometimes clients says, we just lost a big client. We haven't got budget. Like, we have to end the engagement. I don't want to. I love the people working with me, but we have to end it. So, but I'd say on average, 70% of our people get beyond a year. And then once they're beyond a year, it's, you know, it's like, yeah, could see how
phenomenal.
How
we just plan forever, on you at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. And then obviously the talent are getting more and more experience, become more valuable. And, you know, it's nice when we can also have pay rise conversations. You know, you've had someone work with you, Andy, it's been a year and you love them. And it's like, well, how would you feel about paying them a bit more? And she's like, yeah, like, I'd love to pay them a bit more. I mean, it's not a lot of money from, say, US. USA context, dollars, but it's a lot of money in someone living in Kenya. And then that becomes a really pleasurable part of it because they know that that's supporting, you know, families and behind it.
And what is the retention rate of your employees? So obviously they're getting great experience working on these projects. Are you finding competition with either local companies or other outsourcing firms that are coming after the talent that you've groomed?
Yeah, good question, because it is, people do mention to me a lot about that being an issue in India and the Philippines and those traditional markets, because they're such big markets now. They've been around for so long. People move around a lot because it's just so massive. We don't have that problem in Africa yet. I think in 5 years that will become a problem. So there's not this whole poaching that's going on all the time, because there's just, it just doesn't have the size of the industry yet. Having said that, yeah, we lost one guy 6 months ago that got offered a job of 2.5 times his pay. Like, just someone just saw what he's doing. I think he's promoting on LinkedIn and stuff, and which is, we encourage him to do, right? Like, put yourself out there, like, be proud of what you're doing. But then, yeah, someone came along and poached and just offered a massive pay rise. So you're like, you know what, am I disappointed by that? Yeah, it's annoying because we've got to, you know, manage that with the client, find a replacement. It's work for us, but am I proud of it? Yeah, I am proud of that. Like, that's, we've changed this person's life. But for us at the minute, it's about 6-7% maybe is what people are leaving to go to other jobs. And we'll make the most of that for the next 3-4 years. Cause I think, yeah, as I said, in 5 years' time, it'll probably get a lot more competitive when, you know, these people that are doing really good jobs, people are going to tap them on the shoulder.
Right. Yeah, and you're right. The Indian market and the Philippine market, I mean, especially India, I mean, you even can't move. I think it's like a month's notice or something in India that you have to give. And, you know, a lot of times it's just finding the talent, finding the people with that skill set. And even at that, I think the comment you made earlier about the fact that they're more task oriented, right? Hey, I need you to do X, Y, and Z. And to hear you talk about the people in your organization to say, oh no, we're gonna challenge you. That is not a normal behavior in an outsourced situation, but I think that is more of a behavior of a seasoned consultant, right? And for them to have that natural inclination to look at a process or look at something and question it is something that you sometimes can't even train into people. You know, whether it's States or Australia or UK or Canada, even these markets, I work with people all the day long and they're like, oh yeah, that's the way we've always done it. You know,
yeah. And another quick on that, Rich, is, and this is more on the personal side, but we got a client in Australia called Quitch. They're an ed tech company. And I was talking to this about 18 months ago. I was talking to their CEO and he goes, oh, look, Jared, and I said, how's it all going? He goes, yeah, good. He goes, but look, Raleigh and Michael, if I just swear for ones, they take the piss out of me like all the time. I'm like, mate, I'm so sorry. Like, I'll get one of the managers to talk to him. Like, and he goes, what are you talking about? He goes, I love it. It's the best. So it's just like this, the confidence and like just being able to have that bounce around, because you want to have fun at work, right? So right. You don't want your offshore team to be, oh, that's just the offshore team there and stuff.
Right.
It's like, when I get on a call with my team, you know, in South Africa or Kenya, I want to have fun when I get on the call. I want it to be enjoyable. I want to smile. I want it, like, and I think that element, like, can't be underestimated.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And you talked at the beginning when we were talking about, you know, university students, whether they were international or nationals and second-class citizens, it's the same way. Like, you don't want your outsource team to be second-class because there are productivity losses at that point in time. There's lack of trust, all those things. So I love that. Speaking of competition and competition for your resources, AI is competition for your resources. How are you seeing that affect how your customers, how your clients are affecting your workforce and how your workforce is positioning themselves to respond to it?
Yeah, I've gone on a bit of a roller coaster with AI from a personal point of view, like waking up in the middle of the night and sweats. And like, maybe it was 9 months ago, I was like, oh my God, in 5 years, we don't have a business anymore. Like, AI is going to take all the jobs. Why do you need people anymore? And then you think, well, if that happens, we're at like 30% unemployment. Like, there's going to be civil wars happening. But like, okay, that can't happen. Like, Elon cannot be right where we have full abundance and no one needs a job. So that was a short-lived cycle for me. And now I sort of sit in a place of, and it's starting to happen now because more and more clients are, the term human in the middle is coming up all the time. Now, and I think a saying that we talk about a lot internally is that AI won't take your job, but someone using AI will. And I think that is a fairly true statement. I think that will be a true statement. So we're really trying to build a culture where everyone is AI first. And what I mean by that is that I use the term sharpen the axe all the time. Like what is everyone doing to sharpen the axe? And in this case, the axe is AI. So you're doing a process for one of your clients. Like, have you stopped and thought about how you could do that using AI in a much better way? And hopefully it means that we in the future actually have less people working for our clients, but they're doing much, much more valuable work and they're doing more work. So I see it as maybe being a bit of a shrinking thing. Like, I generally believe some jobs are going to disappear. Like, that is going to happen for sure. But other jobs, we've got people that are working for companies that are managing the agents. So that didn't exist 5 months ago, really, but they had built, I mean, the CEO and the COO had gone and built a whole lot of their own agents. I think they were using Anthropic's products. And they're like, how do we manage these? We've got 26 of them now. And like, I don't have time to manage them. So I've got some of our people in South Africa that manage the agents and build more agents for them and doing those type of roles. And so I think, Andy, it's a massive threat, and it's a threat to the developing world in holistically. But I think it's such a big opportunity for the developing world because we've sort of picked Claude as the horse to back for the minute. I think Anthropic's winning the race and you know, that can change easily. But I took a view, let's just pick the product, this technology that's currently the best. And I use Claude all the time. I think it's the greatest technology ever invented. And there's just so much you can do with it. So how do we get all of our people trained and confident to, what I've found, it's actually not the training that is the challenging part, it's the confidence with it. So, you know, are you using AI? Oh yeah, I used AI. What are you chatting to the chatbot's not using AI. So what are you actually using as tools to actually help you do your job? Like, have you tried to use Claude Code? Like, have you got a GitHub account? Have you looked at Versal? Like, have you gone that far to actually see what is capable? Because anything can be learned now if you're willing to put some of the time and the effort in to do it.
Right.
So definitely for us, and the way I think about it is that we need to be like AI native, like complete AI diehards for everyone that's working in our business. So we've got to make sure we have a culture for that. And then a bit like the example I gave before of saying, hey, why don't we do it this way, is that our people are going to their clients saying, hey, you know, if that we could use AI to do whatever this is, and I think we could do it a lot better. I actually spent the weekend playing around with it, and here's how I think it's going to work. We want our people need to be saying that to their clients rather than the other way around. And I think if you don't do that, then I think there's a big risk of getting left behind.
Yeah.
Are you at all concerned with, so in, you know, the last, I don't know, let's say 6-9 months, we've seen a lot of the larger firms, the McKinseys, the Accentures, the Deloittes, get kind of dinged because they're like, you're walking in and giving me an AI presentation. This is, you know, I'm paying $800 for a McKinsey guy to be here, and you're giving me something I could have got from Claude. Is there a little bit of fear of around that, or have you seen that from clients of, but I still want, it's your point, the human in the middle to do the thinking. Like, I get everybody's going to adopt AI to make work more efficient, but is there a fear that they're going to lean on it too heavily? And how do you balance that challenge, I guess?
Yeah, I think two sort of themes there. It'd be interesting to see what happens to the BCGs and the McKinseys of the world over the next 5 years, because like they sell in knowledge and intelligence, right? And now that's free, as easy as you want to get it. And I already know some, you know, large tech or businesses that are completely scaling back what they're spending with those consulting companies. And my position has been to build with, well, the discussions with clients is, why pay $100,000? Because there's AI consultants everywhere, right? They're popping out of the woodwork everywhere. Like, right. Why pay $100,000, $200,000 for someone to tell you the time on your watch? Right. So yes, you're a nice PowerPoint saying, here's what you need to do. What you need to do is execute and iterate and modify in using these tools. And that's been my experience in playing myself. So the conversations I then flip over to those clients that are thinking about maybe using a consultant, so why don't you just get someone on a monthly rate that loves AI, that can sit next to you every single day and build stuff with you for the next year? And it will still cost you 30% of what you're going to pay that consultant for the 2 month job.
Yeah.
Because the reality is things are going to change as you go. But once you get into these things, and I'm sure you guys have experienced too, like the ideas that pop out, like you're doing something like, oh my God, I could do this. You're like,
right.
Yes, we could go and build this now. Like, you don't even know what's possible yet.
Yeah.
So I'd prefer to have someone that is smart, that's sitting with me inside the business, that is just, because we don't, I mean, as the leaders of businesses, we don't get time necessarily to go down some of these rabbit holes. Well, you've got someone just going down whichever rabbit hole you want. And then the other realization, I think, is that the leaders in businesses, they actually know what they want. Like, they're smart people. So they sort of know the outcome sort of is what they want to get. And so if you could say to someone, hey, I think we can do this. I know our business back to front. Here's what I think we can do with it. Can you go and have a play and come back to me? I mean, we actually had this happen with one of our clients in Brisbane, that they're a consulting infrastructure client, and they've got a lady called Andy Andiswa in Johannesburg. She's a marketing manager, loves using Claude. And this exact thing happened where the CEO said to her one day in week two, just said, one day I want to do this. And it was just an absolute throwaway comment. He said 7 days later or something like that, she booked a meeting in his diary, and they got on a call, and she brought up a web page because it's all built in that. You can build this stuff and all in HTML now, and showed him all this data about every project happening around Australia and what's over budget, what's under budget, who's doing it, who's the developer, whatever. And like, oh, everything's clicked through. Like, and he's like, yeah, it's probably the best piece of work I've ever been delivered in my life. And he knows the business. He knows sort of what he wants. So there's no point telling McKenzie's that I want to go and do this, and they come back with a report about how they're going to build and charge whatever. Just having someone sitting there that on the weekend just went and built for them and can then go and iterate with it. To me, I think that's how AI should get implemented in a business, as opposed, and I worry for the consultants around that.
Yeah. I think we see that a lot with our clients too, that it's that, first of all, you've got to get started and you've got to understand that it is going to be, the time scales are ridiculous compared to the old world of going through a year-long, you know, transformation program where you put in a big software and it's a full year before you even get live. And then you get in and then you start using it and you're like, oh, I would have made decisions differently. Like that, you know, the speed is incredible, I think. But because again, once you're in, you will make decisions differently, but it is still putting in that structure and recognizing that your first pass is going to be thrown away in 6 weeks, 6 months. The time frame doesn't matter so much, exactly. But you're going to, it could be 6 days that you're like, okay, but now we go. Here we go, round two. Let's go. I think that's, probably one of the most interesting things that we've seen with our clients is just how quickly things shift, and that continual transformation, that continual change management is really critical.
We've never had this opportunity to iterate so fast now. Like, you can literally iterate twice inside of a day. And I call it the dopamine hit. I think that's why I love using AI, because you get the self-gratification like immediately. Like, I can go and build something this afternoon. I can see it working straight away. I can go and change it. I didn't have to go and brief a team of four developers to go and build this thing for me. Like, the product manager is the developer, is the product owner. Like, that's, I think, why it's so exciting.
Yeah.
We literally just went live yesterday with a client who in 90 days built a whole new product, never had been in this market. So they built a whole new product, launch a brand new product, a brand new revenue stream for their company in 90 days. We started with, to your point, a vibe fest and iterating. And then over the last 90 days, it's been an interesting journey from, you know, years ago when we built banking platforms in the 90s, you know, when online banking was big, to Salesforce, which was supposed to be no code, get it in really quickly, to this where they literally built it from scratch, integrated it to where it needed to be integrated and launched. And to your point, their next launch is 30 days away.
Yeah. What and product, what did they use to build it?
Claude.
Yeah. Love it.
Yeah. Yeah. And even during the Vibe Fest, the way we approached it was that they all, each team kind of came with their version of what they're contributing to the product, like the marketing team, the finance team. And what was really amazing about it, and I think, you know, kind of what you're saying in terms of the future is getting out of people's heads what they think they need and putting it on paper. Because when we walked the ELT through it, most of them were like, oh, now I get it. But had we walked through a PowerPoint, they'd be like, okay, but what is it? What does that mean? What does that look like? And I find myself a lot of times, even when we talk about with clients, is, okay, just build a prototype. Like, we can, to your point, we can do it in 24 hours and it's going to be directionally correct. But the fact that people can touch it and feel it and press it is, I think, changing people's minds. And to your point, the dopamine, they're like, well, you did this how quickly?
Yeah.
Now, I think there's a little bit of fear there, because now they're like, let's go change it. And to the point you and Annie make is like, well, now we have something that people really suck at for years and years is change management.
Yes. There are still people in this. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's because it's taken so long, right? These are 9-month programs, even with Salesforce, even with the best of situations, right? And so you have the buildup. But 90 days to change, to launch product, have your sales team ready, your marketing team ready, your support team ready to do all that, like that's a lot. And so to your point, to have a team of people who get it, who understand it, and who can iterate on that and deliver that really quickly, I think that's what people are going to need in the future.
Yeah. And how's the energy in the room when that happens too? It's like light bulbs going off everywhere, and then
that's
that
exactly
just
right.
Feeds on itself.
Yeah. Yep. Work is fun again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Definitely.
How do you see, you said, you know, you think in 5 years competition's gonna heat up. Do you think that is from outsourcers coming? Do you think it's from companies now building talent centers within Africa? Where do you think that competition comes from?
So in the Africa context, I think it will. I think as more and more people realize the quality of the talent, then you just end up moving into those markets. And it's already happening now. And you know, Google and Amazon, the big Microsoft, the big companies have set up or are setting up, you know, big footprints on the continent. And then as people realize that the talent is there, you start shifting, you know, maybe from India or some of these other markets into some of these African markets. So look, India's 40 years into this, Philippines 25, 30, you know, Africa is still pretty young. So the next frontier will be the African frontier. I mean, every second person entering the workforce by 2035 will live on the continent of Africa just by sheer weight of numbers. So it's sort of there's the macro tailwinds, but there's also, as more and more businesses realize the talent exists, you're naturally just going to go there.
And do you think that's just going to be consulting outsourced talent, or do you see a situation where people may move manufacturing? I mean, manufacturing has always been this weird thing, right? Like the US had it. In the Industrial Revolution, we got rid of it. People have argued we should bring manufacturing back. They're never gonna. And then you've gotten to places where, you know, China, Philippines, Vietnam, like some of these other places, which are now starting to get a little more expensive from, you know, I use air quotes, compared to, you know, Canada, US, Australia. Do you see that as a viable option, as manufacturing moving there? Or do you think it's more going to just be this tech talent?
Knowledge.
No, I think, like, and it's already happening. There's a city that's been built in about 25 kilometers from Nairobi called Tatu City, and it's got a massive industrial park. It's got, you know, manufacturing. It's literally a city's been built, and a lot of, and you drive through it, right? You see these massive plants and things that are happening. But then I take it a step further, and I'll give you an example. I met with three gentlemen, well, maybe 6 months ago. One's from Ghana, one's from Nigeria, and one's from Kenya in Melbourne. And all three of them were planning to move back to Africa. And they've been in Australia for a long time, built great lives here. So, well, why are you moving back? Says the opportunity. Like, and you mentioned China before, right? Everyone wants to trade with China now. Do you think people wanted to trade with China 15 years ago, like as a market? Like, you want to get into the Chinese market. So just think about the potential of being able to trade in Africa and build, you know, a business and clientele in some of these countries that are going to grow so fast with such a young population.
Right.
So it's not just things like manufacturing, which is happening anyway. It's like, and we've got some clients, there's a client of ours called Trafio. They've got traffic management software, and they have expanded into Africa by getting some people through us to go, and they've picked up their first three clients in South Africa already. It's only been 4 or 5 months, I think. But they're like, well, okay, we're in the US, we're in the UK. US going, well, UK is okay. What about Africa for us? Like, what's happening for infrastructure? So the amount of infrastructure that's going to get built in Africa over the next 50 years is going to blow your mind. He says, well, we need to get in now. So they're seeing it not only as having access to talent that, you know, for them, you know, it's obviously very affordable, but they're like, it's actually a growth market for us now. So now they're winning clients in those markets. And I think more and more businesses are going to realize that, hey, we should start thinking about now about how we're going to trade on the African continent in order to build revenue for our business.
What's the political situation? So you've always heard about, you know, you get apartheid, you get the you, you kind of mentioned the Rwanda situation. Years ago, I had a boss who did some work in Africa through missions. And he said, you know, we need armed guards at our places because our laptops keep on getting stolen. And so you talk about the population explosion. And so that creates potentially instability because you have so many people and only so many jobs. And if AI really does shrink the job market, what do you think happens in terms of the political, you know, stability of Africa as the population explodes, as growth explodes, but also as the need for jobs? So do we have a very divided society where we have the really poor and the really rich, you know, which you've seen in India a lot?
Yeah, a couple of angles around that. So one is, I've probably spent 250 nights in Africa now, and I've never ever had an issue. One example is, a scenario is that when I was first in Addis in Ethiopia, and that's the capital city. And I think we'd actually gone out to a sports bar, actually. I had meetings for the day and gone out to a sports bar with some of the locals and chatting with someone there. And they mentioned, in the civil war that's happening in Ethiopia. I'm like, what do you mean a civil war? There's a civil war happening at the top of our country. I'm like, I probably should have researched that before I came here and told my wife. I said, okay, well, we'll talk you through that. So, you know, it's up near the border of Somalia. And I said, well, what would that be like? I said, well, look, I said, you know, my safe. And he said, look, the capital cities are fine. Like, you're in a big capital city here. If you want to jump in a car and you want to drive 4 hours north, you're probably potentially going to get in some problems, right? So don't do that. And that for me was a bit of like, yes, there are spots that are going to be dangerous you don't go into. And when I was in Chicago, which I think is an amazing city, like the locals there said, yeah, don't go south for past 33rd Street because you probably won't come back out. And it's the same type of principles, I think, apply that if you're in the big cities and the areas that you should be into, just don't go into places that are probably a bit unsafe. And then what I was in San Francisco, this is now 18 months ago, and so I'd spent all these nights in Africa, never had a problem. And again, I'd be sitting in a cafe in Kigali in Rwanda, and I would have my Mac, and I'd go to the bathroom. I'd leave my Mac on the table in a cafe. I'd go to the bathroom and I'd come back. I did not think for a second that anyone would ever take it. And in fact, Rwanda's even rated as being the sixth safest place to travel alone as a female. Very extremely safe place. But I was in San Francisco, broad daylight, doing the same thing, had my Mac out. I was doing a bit of work, and this car drove up. These guys jumped out with hoodies over their heads, came at me, grabbed me, took my Mac. Like, mugged in broad daylight in San Francisco. And I tell that story because we have all these connotations about, you know, Africa and, you know, all the stories that get told. And yeah, sure, these stories are probably happening. But I feel more on edge in a city like San Francisco, to be honest, than I do in Cape Town or Johannesburg or Nairobi or any of these cities. Now, I'm used to being in Africa as well. But I think it's the same principles applies no matter where you go in the world. Is, you know, make sure you're not going to parts that are, you know, dodgy parts, you know, keep your wits about you at all times, you know, and you know, plan and be, and you can set yourself in a safe environment. So it's a long-winded answer for you, Rich, but I've never felt unsafe. Nothing's ever happened to me. And my bottom line there is that I feel less safe in San Francisco.
Right. No, I lived in Chicago and I was once looking at, look at this place, it's gorgeous, I'm gonna go look at this, and got in my car 9 o'clock at night, kept on driving, wound up in South Chicago, and I'm looking around, I'm like, I do not belong here, and I whipped my car around because you're right, even I knew that wasn't some place I needed to be, right? And those places exist, and the reason I asked is you hear so much more, at least, you know, the political connotation, corruption, you know, suppression of people, you know, we get all the negative, right? There's never, you never really get the positive about most places, at least not on the news or what you read. So it's good to get a perspective from somebody who lives it, right? And whenever you travel somewhere, it's like, you want to talk to the locals. You don't want to talk to like the guides and the, you know, read on the internet, oh, stay away from 34th Street. You know, is 34th Street really bad? No, it's not. That's just some made up thing because somebody was mugged there once 3 years ago, right? So,
right. But I like that. I mean, and obviously the sheer size of Africa, like You have somebody like Gerard who's like, you're going to go here. You're not going to go here. So it helps to have a guide to who can tell you where the hot spots are.
Yeah. And I think, and on a positive angle too, and this is something that really surprised me about, you know, having business in Africa, is that females run the place. Like, and the most impressive people I've met in senior roles are all females. So they tend to run the family life, but they're very, very prominent in the business world. And the amount of business meetings, this is with governments and with large corporates as well, I would have dealt with more females in Africa in those senior roles than I have in the USA, Australia, UK. It's still very male dominated in those markets. There's just like such a high amount is driven by females in Africa, and that I was found amazing.
That's really interesting observation.
Yeah. Nice. Good to hear.
That's good. Well, usually when we close these out, we close out with a lightning round of random questions to catch you off guard. Not really, but random questions. One country or city in Africa that most people underestimate for talent. Where's the biggest surprise?
Nairobi.
Interesting. What's one thing that you'd tell your CFO era, your finance era self about the future of work?
Wait till you can put Claude into Excel. It's going to blow your mind.
I love that you put Excel in there, because I have to say, Excel is still like one of the most fabulous tools ever invented, but Claude blows that all to bits. Yeah.
I had this like realization a couple of weeks ago when I needed, and I'm an accountant by trade, right? So I can actually write formulas in Excel. I'm a decent modeler. And I had to change this really simple formula. And I know it had, like, I could have just gone to the cell and changed the formula. Instead, I told Claude to change it. And I was like, oh, this is where
so it's good. So good. Absolutely.
Once you just get voice Claude on your phone, it's done, right? Just
game over.
For me, game over.
Oh my gosh, good.
Can you do that with Claude in Excel? Like, can I tell Claude to do stuff in Excel for me? I haven't tried that yet. And that's,
I mean, it has to be.
I was going to say, you can ask him to build it and deliver it in Excel. So I would imagine that you could also say modify it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, eventually it'd be like, Jared, you're 5% below budget, you know, this quarter. Like, Claude, go find me some more clients. And then Claude goes off.
I like that.
Well, you tell the robots and the robots go out, you know.
Okay. Podcast, book, blog, or other similar that has stuck with you in the last 90 days?
Last 90 days. So I've started really listening to the All In podcast religiously the last 90 days. I'm a bit AI obsessed, and those guys have got some pretty good content. I'm fascinated by the data center industry for AI. So we got to build the real world infrastructure to support the digital world. So they talk a lot about that. So yeah, I've been giving a lot of attention to those guys lately.
Nice. Good. Well, we've loved having you here. Where can people go to find out more about Talent Match Africa?
So I'm on LinkedIn. So I, if people message me on LinkedIn, I always reply. So, and then talentmatchafrica.com is our website. But Jared Excellent. Holland is my LinkedIn URL. There's no numbers and stuff against it.
Perfect. Perfect. Excellent.
Awesome. Well, thank you for your time.
So good. Yeah.
Interesting.
Very, very fascinating conversation. Yeah. Excellent.
Yeah, thanks Andy and Rich for both having me. It's been fun.
Thanks. We'll talk soon.